Okay. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the System Safety and Operations Committee meeting, Thursday, February 16th, 2012. I apologize for our late start, but most of you have been here and seeing the great work that the Construction Committee was doing throughout the morning. And now we're ready to pick up where they left off. May we have roll call, please?
Director Lizar.
Present.
Here.
Here. Thank you. Thank you. We do have a quorum. Let's move to the first item, item 37.
Good afternoon. We're going to start for the second month consecutive providing recognition for two of our stellar employees, Transportation Employee of the Month and a Maintenance Employee of the Month. Going to ask the respective executive directors to introduce them.
Good morning. John Roberts, Executive Director of Transportation. It's my pleasure to introduce Operator Larry Simon as Transportation's Operator of the Month for February 2012. Operator Simon has been selected Operator for the Month because of his outstanding performance, his record of complaints, incidents, accidents, his miss-out, and his attendance is excellent. In fact, his last miss-out was over 6 years ago because of a major plumbing problem. So he's gotten over 6 years without a miss-out. Operator Simon was born and raised in Los Angeles and is currently a resident of Canoga Park. Operator Simon has spent the last 10 years with Metro. He's currently assigned to Division 8, but has also worked Divisions 2, 10, and 15. He is known for his great attitude and enjoys his job as an operator. His hobbies include exercising and staying fit, which we appreciate. Please welcome with me Operator Simon.
I'd like to thank the management at Division 8, Gary and Ralph Gray, and the board membership for this award. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Hey, John, a quick question. When was your last accident, your last chargeable?
I haven't had an accident, sir.
I feel... We have much in common. When I was an operator, I went 6 weeks before I had an accident, so I know exactly... what you're talking about. Thank you for your work.
Mr. Leahy, how many Operator of the Month awards did you get?
Alas, my career as an operator was cut short, tragically.
Thank you.
Don't go away,
Mr. Simon. We'll be down there for some photos as soon as we hear from our great maintenance worker. Yes, thank you.
Good afternoon. Alex Anizzo, Director of Maintenance. I'd like to introduce our Maintenance Employee of the Month, Salvador Martinez. Sal's been with us for over 11 years. Sal represents our maintenance departments, and just a little bit earlier, someone was surprised to find out that Sal's not a mechanic, nor is he a service attendant. He's an ECT. He's an electronics communication technician, and what Sal does is Sal's our farebox technician. What Sal does is that he rebuilds the fareboxes, he diagnoses and troubleshoots our fareboxes. So we, in maintenance, we do have more than just mechanics and just service attendants. Sal works at our central maintenance facility in one of our shops. Sal has worked at various maintenance locations. Sal has an exemplary record, an outstanding safety record, an outstanding attendance record, and it's just an honor and a privilege to have Sal on our maintenance team. Alberto Martinez.
Thank you. Thank you very much for recognizing my efforts, and I accept this award with pride. Thank you.
Thank you. And any directors who would like to join me for a photo recognition of these great gentlemen's efforts, yeah, you're more than welcome. Mr. Leahy, too.
Appreciate your hard work. Appreciate no accidents, no missouts. Spread that. Whatever you have for breakfast, spread that to the rest of the
Congratulations.
Congratulations, sir.
Appreciate it.
Shake back your right hand here. Congratulations. Congratulations. That's what I'm doing.
All right.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Let's move on then to, were there any cards? Not on that item. I saw some come up recently. On item 38, please. Transit operations report.
To continue, we've got the same series of slides that we provided over the last year or so. We unfortunately loaded the wrong month in here. She's on the way back down with the correct month, but I believe you have copies of what I'm going to speak to. The first slide is customer complaints. For the month of December, they were at 2.89 per 100,000 boardings, a decrease over November. Year-to-date, the complaints are above the goal, but remain below the mark in FY09. Next slide. The bus operator assignment ratio increased very slightly to a 1.17 in December, just below the target of 1.2. The January report will show that it increases to 1.182, and month-to-date in February, we're at 1.18. We expect to reach the steady state of 1.20 in April. Next slide, the operator assignment ratio for rail. It decreased from November. We took the Expo student pipeline out of the reported numbers, and so it more accurately reflects the ratio. Next slide. Fare revenue operations, FY12 December year-to-date. We're close to being on target with the budget for fare revenues, with January actual slightly less than the budget. And next slide. System-wide bus boardings, December average weekday boardings decreased to 1,070,072 boardings, representing a decrease over November by 6.6%. This is historically typical during the holidays, and we expect it will increase after the start of the year. Next slide, the rail boardings. Average weekday boardings for rail were 294,082, a slight decrease from November, again, as expected, because of the holidays. Next slide, service reliability bus. For the month of November, on-time performance was 76.09%, a slight decrease from November. Buses hot were up slightly at 4.7%. We know too high. We've taken an advanced look at the numbers for January, and it'll be reported at just short of 79%, continuing back where we were headed, with running hot down to 2.9. The next slide provides some historical perspective starting in FY06. Year-to-date on-time performance is up slightly from last year, and we'd make the note that compared to FY06, we were at 64%, and today we're up 12 percentage points to just over 76%. Next slide on bus cleanliness, good news story. The operating division cleanliness report scores system-wide for December were at 8.39, an increase from November and over the target of 8.0. All divisions were at, very close at or above the goal. Next slide, fleet right reliability bus. Mean miles between mechanical failures for the month were at 41.03, an improvement over the month of November. Our year-to-date, we've improved 15% from FY09. Next slide. In fact, the last one in my presentation, I wanted to make a note initially that we're preparing a report to the committee in March to provide an update on our actions over the last couple years to change the culture, procedures, and expectations in dealing with accidents. The other point on this last slide involves the Blue Line cars, and we just want to give you an update on what we've been doing. The customers have noticed. We've had a number of comments about so-called new cars on the Blue Line. They're the Siemens P2000, part of that fleet that was transferred from the Gold Line to support the Expo opening. As we started receiving Breda cars into the fleet, we removed the P2000s, removed them for cosmetic makeover with some modifications, and then we did complete body work and paint. We deep cleaned the interior. We made some signaling system modifications and the required PA announcements given the change in stations. The painting effort took 18 months. We've held them out of service until pre-revenue to minimize the opportunity for vandalism and graffiti. They entered Blue Line Revenue Service the first week of this month. Subject to any questions, that completes my report.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Mitchell? Okay. Are there any cards on that item? Thank you. This is a receive, file and receive, and thank you. No objection. Such will be our action. Next item, please. Item 39.
Committee. My name is Vijay Kawani, and I'm the Executive Officer of the Corporate Safety Department. Item 39 is a report on safety key performance indicators and system safety issues. Our first slide shows our safety trend for bus accidents per 100,000 hub miles. The upper graph shows this on a monthly basis, and the lower graph shows that on a fiscal year basis. And as we can see, the trend is creeping in a negative direction, and we are working closely with operations, as Mr. Mitchell stated earlier, to try to reverse that trend. We have established an executive-level committee that reviews this on a monthly basis, and we have also identified very specific types of accidents or collisions that we will be focusing on, the types that we believe are completely controllable by our bus operators. The trend in the rail area is a positive trend. We have seen a continuous decrease both on a monthly basis and a fiscal year basis, although it shows a relatively flat trend if you look at it from a fiscal year standpoint. Our challenge continues to be the Blue Line that has several grade crossings, and we are working with our community relations staff to conduct outreach efforts for the public. In many cases, those accidents are caused by unsafe acts and behaviors of the public. We are also focusing on engineering improvements that we will be implementing in the coming fiscal year to try to combat that area. This slide is more of a sort of a lagging indicator. The first two I presented were, this is more of a leading indicator. The first two I presented were lagging indicators. And this presents the results of our mystery rider program on the bus mode. The program is conducted by a contractor who has staff that go out on the various bus routes to evaluate compliance with various issues, customer service, ADA compliance, as well as safety. And what we're showing here is a safety portion of that evaluation. There, it represents approximately 200 observations that are conducted on a monthly basis. And as we can see, the upper slide, the upper graphs, show whether operators are complying with the rule on wearing seat belts and making sure that all the patrons are behind the yellow safety line before operating the bus. And we see a relatively good trend in that area. We have been so for the last few months. The thing that's a little troubling is the bottom graph. And it shows two safety issues. One is compliance with cell phones or electronic devices. We seem to have really controlled that. Initially, when we started the program, we were observing many operators who were using the cell phone while operating buses, and we seem to have a good handle on it. For example, in December, it was 0%. We had no observations of operators using cell phones. The area that concerns us a little bit is operators running red lights, as the bottom graph shows. We were on a very good trend there for the last 4 months, on a good downward trend, and all of a sudden, we jumped in December. And we are working with operations to identify those operators and take appropriate actions with those operators. In addition to the Mystery Rider program, we will also be focusing on the camera system that is onboard our buses, the smart drive system, to try to identify operators who do run red lights and take appropriate actions. This presents the leading indicators on the rail mode. The upper graph shows this broken down by line, by the four lines that we have, red, blue, green, and gold, and the various types of incidents that we see typically that are considered leading indicators. For example, again, unlike the bus mode, on the rail mode we have a signal system. So the first column shows violations of red signals on the main line. At intersections where we have gates that get broken, the control center usually informs the operator that there is a broken gate at the crossing ahead and to stop before proceeding. In some cases, those advisories are not heeded to, so we track those. The third column shows violations in the yard with red signals. Doors opening on the wrong side of the platforms. As you know, we have different types of platforms. Some of them are center platforms. Some of them are side platforms. And when an operator pulls into the station, they have to make sure they open the doors on the wrong side for obvious reasons. So we have those incidents that occur. Improper berthing, where the train is not fully in the station with the doors being open. Violation of stop orders. RWP violation, and RWP stands for Roadway Worker Protection. That is when we have our employees who are working along on the alignments adjacent to the tracks. We have certain rules that they have to follow, both the operators and the people working on the wayside. And so if there's a violation of any of those rules, we track that and see how we're performing. A manual block violation, that is, in essence, is a certain distance that is allocated by the control center, and you're supposed to not violate that area. So if there's any violation of that manual block, we track that. And change in modes. For example, we have different modes. We have an automatic mode and a manual mode, and operators are not allowed to change modes without getting authorization from the control center. So those are the typical things that we track and are leading indicators on the rail mode. It shows it by line. The bottom graph shows that.
Can I interrupt you for just a moment?
Sure.
On the red signal mainline violations.
Yes, sir.
On Metrolink, the agency makes a huge deal about that. And I know there may be some federal regulations as well, but the train set is stopped, the operator is removed. In fact, all the operators are removed, and the train is taken basically out of service. It's a huge deal. Do we, and these are relatively, you know, three on the red, six on the blue. I mean, if you add those together, we're at maybe 15 or more incidents in half a year. Do we make as big a deal as that as Metrolink? does. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Metrolink, but it is a big deal. I mean, the train is stopped, it is not moved, operator taken off duty, I think, for at least more than one shift. Is that something we do when we have our violations of this nature?
I think I'm going to defer that to operations because I'm not sure what...
Isn't that right, Director Kanabe? I mean, it's a major, major issue that...
it is. It is a major, major issue on our lines, too. I'll let Frank Alejandro address that.
My name is Frank Alejandro, Executive Officer for Operations Administration for Metro. And, yes, we do remove the operator from service. He is drug screened. We investigate the technical reports and see, try and capture what actually happened. So that's our actions that we take.
Every director on Metrolink gets an emergency blast that there was a violation of a crossing, even if it's just by a matter of a few meters. I think we need to maybe discuss ways to make it more more serious. Not that you're not taking it serious, but more of a highlighted and broadcasted event amongst the agency so everyone knows this is a very serious transgression when it comes to operating these train lines.
We are fortunate here that we have a SCADA system that reports immediately when an operator violates a signal. So upon that notification to the control center over the radio, we stop the train, we send the supervisor, remove the operator from service, and do follow-up action with that.
Okay. I've just had a side discussion with Mr. Leahy, who has a comment on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, Frank Alejandro has been in this job as a number two guy in operations for, what, about 60 days now, something like that?
Yes.
And
hopefully 61.
He actually has worked in San Francisco and, what was that place? Oh, yeah, Minnesota.
Minnesota.
And has been in transit operations for more than 30 years. And I want you to know he very much comes from the school that you're referring to, there, especially on rail, where the magnitude is so serious, the order of magnitude of a problem is so serious that we just cannot be cavalier about rule violations. And this is a major rule violation.
Yes.
So, Frank, let's talk later on about how we might report this to the board in a thoughtful fashion.
Okay.
And a lot of this comes from the top down, at least with Metrolink, using that as an analogy. And
right.
To the extent that it's starting from the top, I think, with Mr. Leahy's assistance, I think we can impress on the operators and their managers that we are going to be taking a much closer look at this and take some action. Mr. Fasano.
You know, in terms of our system, what is SCADA?
They're immediately reported to SCADA. The controller then calls over the radio and stops the train. We send a supervisor. The operator is removed from service and drug tested. So that's our procedure. Now, we do post-incident meetings with the safety department to go over and do a check and balance of the rules and procedures, as well as reviewing the technical reports so that we make sure it doesn't happen again. We're very fortunate that most of our signal systems on our railroads have positive train control, which means that the train will stop before it gets near the other train. However, there are some locations that don't have that.
And that's a good point.
But again, going back to this, I mean, these are serious violations, but the way the light rail system is built, there are, with the SCADA system, there are additional safety factors as backups that we would ideally never need to go to that level, but they are there.
Yes.
You know, I would just offer that employees pay attention to the things that their boss pays attention to. In closed session, we've had discussions on accidents on the bus side, which I think represents the same issue of having to recapture a very, very intense focus on safety and rules and procedures, and that there's a right way to do business. When you have a set of rules, those are not suggestions. Those are requirements for the employees to follow, and that applies to this as well. And when you violate the rules, the potential is that you end up with a fatality, and that's just not a risk that we want to tolerate.
Okay, I think we got the message
so we'll follow up with
across,
you.
And Mr. Leahy, I'm sure you'll be able to.
We take it very serious, though. We do.
Thank you. Okay, I'm sorry for the interruption. You were the graph right below that one, rail.
The graph on the bottom shows this on a fiscal year basis and a comparison of those same incidents, FY11 compared to FY12. And as we see, the one that really is of serious concern is the red signal violations in the main line.
So the red is the FY12?
FY12, yes, that's correct. There is also a program called efficiency testing that is required by the federal regulations and state regulations. And so what we do is, with safety and operations, we work very closely together to develop scenarios to really keep the attention and the focus of operators on red signals. And as Frank mentioned, the majority of these signal violations are occurring at locations where we do not have positive train control, where you're completely reliant on the operator's observation of that red signal and the ability to stop that train. So even a moment's distraction, for whatever reason, causes them to lose sight of that signal, and they don't remember what that signal color was. So we have tests called efficiency tests that we actually go in, and we're proposing to do that on a more aggressive basis to raise the awareness of the importance of this rule violation.
I'll find out.
Now, unfortunately, despite our efforts to address safety issues with our operators, the public is also the other part of the equation that comes into play when we see accidents occurring. And in order to address the public component and the public's compliance with warning devices, we have the Community Relations Department that goes out on a regular basis, and this is an ongoing program that has been implemented for years, to conduct outreach. This slide shows the efforts of that. They conduct that through presentations, through tours, at schools, businesses, community events, to basically educate the public about rail safety. One such event, we did that very recently in January at the Florence station on the Blue Line. It was a joint effort by Metro staff and the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department to raise the awareness of safety. Mr. Taylor attended that event and spoke at the event. We had very good media coverage. And after the event was concluded, for about 4 hours, the Los Angeles Sheriff's deputies, patrolled a section of the line, and with the effort of either both educating the public and also citing people who disobeyed the warning devices at the crossings. And in about a four-hour period, they issued 200 citations to motorists and pedestrians who for their unsafe behavior, unsafe acts. And that's a big challenge in trying to educate the public every day at all the locations with the number of grade crossings that we have on the Blue Line. But the effort continues. I think that's a very, very critical component of our program. And finally, this slide shows the status of our what we call corrective action plans. And the corrective action plans are developed in response to audits and inspections that are conducted. There are two types of audits. One is the internal safety audit that is conducted by the Corporate Safety Department, and the other one is the triennial audit that is conducted by the Public Utilities Commission. Now, the reason I put this slide in here is because as a result of the June accident in 2009 in Washington, D.C., the WMATA board, the Washington Board of Directors, was criticized by the NTSB for not knowing what the status of their corrective action plans were. There were no reports being made to the board or committee members on what the corrective actions were, how many were open, why was it taking very long to close them. And so we thought this was a good slide to present to keep you apprised of what they are and what are we doing to close those corrective actions. So as you can see, in the 2011 internal safety review, we still have 11 open corrective actions. In the triennial review, we have 6 open, and we have none on the PUC inspections. The reason these corrective actions are open is because we rely on the other department's assistance to help us close it, whether it's transportation or whether it's maintenance. Now, the good news is that none of them are very serious, with the exception of 2. The majority of them are administrative-type issues, such as revising a maintenance plan or making sure that we have the proper documentation the maintenance is being done, so on and so forth. and we hope to close all of these by the end of this fiscal year. We also provide the updates on a regular basis to the PUC to keep them apprised as to how we're progressing with our plans. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any comments or questions? Okay. I do have a speaker, Worth Baker.
I just had one idea to help explain to the public like these different issues. It's actually pretty cheap to produce web episodes these days, and I just like just throwing it out there. But like you could have like a sheriff and his dog like every week. It's kind of like a kid show, or it could be kind of a parody as well. Experience like a different safety issue, and if there was some humor in it, people would probably watch, and it'd probably drive a lot of people to the website.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't have any other cards, and if there's no comments or questions from my colleagues on the committee, with no objection, we will receive this report. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item is item 40. Commander.
Good afternoon, Commander Jordan, L.A. County Sheriffs. I'm going to give you an overview of just our basic crime stats and key numbers, but also talk about our fare evasion audit that we did and a unique fare enforcement problem or fare evasion problem that we've identified over the last several months. So here you're looking at the past 24 months. So we're comparing the latest 12 months to the previous 12 months, and you can see that for January we're up to Part 1 crimes, but overall the trend is downward. And This is our arrests. You can see the arrests are up for the month of January. That's in part because of some efficiency improvements that we implemented, but also because you guys voted on an increase in personnel, and that's reflected in these numbers. This is citations. As you can see, we're way up on citations. Also, that's an outgrowth of the increase in personnel, but also enforcement along the Expo line. Your guys are running trains on the Expo line. We sent motors over there to educate the public by giving citations, and we've given over 900 citations just in January alone on the Expo line. And this is our calls for service. We do have an increase in calls for service. People might see that as a bad thing. I see that as a good thing. That means public is calling when they see things, and they just make us more efficient by letting us know where the problems are at instead of leaving us up for us to find them. This is, as you know, we're required to maintain certain response times. So here are our average response times. The top line is routine calls, which is basically that's like a report call or something that happened yesterday and we're going to write the report. We want to be 30 minutes or less. The middle line is your priority calls. We want to be 20 minutes or less on that, and we're running a 12-month average of a little over 16 minutes. And, of course, the emergent calls is we want to be 10 minutes or less, and we're running about 7.2 minutes for all emergent calls, which is pretty good given that we cover 1,400 square miles and most of our calls for service are on buses. This is the audit. I know there's a lot of numbers there, but if you look at the top chart, the one in the corner there, it says 10% right at the bottom of the first chart. Put my glasses on because I thought I could do this without them. Okay, now that reflects, in addition to evasion, it also reflects the misuse of fare. Now, we started tracking tap cards where people aren't tapping, and which has bumped up our numbers, which are traditionally between somewhere between 2.5% to 4%. So that number has gone up because of the misuse of fare, because people aren't tapping. However, when you factor out those that have tapped but have actually paid, meaning they got a rolling pass but they activated that pass, it drops it back down to the rate that we've been used to seeing over the last 2 years as we do these audits. The next little chart underneath the first chart, go back, Mike, is that shows the saturation rate. So that would give you the number of people that actually had tap cards. So all the people that we checked, 51% had tap cards. And of those, it shows what percentage of those did not tap. And on the bottom one, that's the same type of chart, only that is deputies working in plain clothes. So it's a comparison of uniform enforcers versus plain clothes. There is a deviation on this in that we normally see the numbers are much closer in terms of evasion, meaning usually we'll see a little higher number on uniform or plain clothes, But they're not that far apart. This is unusual. We'll just have to track this over time as we do our quarterly audits to see if that deviation continues. Next slide. Now, this here, this shows you guys implemented a policy of rolling passes. So of those folks that had tap cards and didn't tap, what we're looking for are those that have tap cards that had no money on it, because that's obviously evasion. But we're also looking for the misuse of fare, which would be those people who have a tap card with money on it, but they did not activate the tap card. It's a rolling tap card, a monthly or weekly pass. They didn't activate it. Those are fare evasion. Now, if they had activated their card and their money on it and they didn't tap, we gave those people warnings. If they didn't activate their card or they had no money on their tap card, they got citations. So this represents the numbers for both the uniform and plain clothes of those folks who had tap cards but hadn't actually paid for that ride. Next slide. Several months ago, actually it's about a year ago, we started negotiating with Access Services about looking at the abuse of the handicap passes. And during the investigation, we found several different scams that are being used by folks to cheat Metro, cheat Access, and cheat MetroLink out of revenues. So we had a detective look at all these things, and we found that actually a fair percentage of the tap card or the Access cards were stolen or being used by somebody who wasn't authorized to use them. And a lot of the people who did, who we did capture doing that, also had lengthy criminal records. Next slide. Some were counterfeit, some were stolen, some were given to them to use by somebody else. So it's a variety of things. This is what we've done over the past approximately 6 months with this program, or a little longer than 6 months, 7 months. So we had a detective assigned. He's become an expert in this. And our goal is, of course, reduce stolen, forged, or misuse of paratransit cards. Basically, we made 79 arrests of theft of services via these Access cards. The DA is filing misdemeanors on these, except if the person has a criminal record, then he's filing felonies. So the method that we're using to enforce the abuse of this, we're finding out might be a very good method for enforcing abuse of handicapped seniors and students for the tap card. The tap cards, in essence, is an Access card. And if you use that without the permission of the cardholder or the permission of the agency, it is technically a misdemeanor. So we're going to be working with TAP because we do need to get some timely information from the TAP office as to whether who owns a particular card to be able to enforce a similar type abuse of senior, student, or handicapped folks with Metro TAP cards. So we see this as it's been a great learning experience for us. And this all counts as evasion that has not ever been captured in our numbers. We do get some enforcement numbers when people abuse this stuff, but we're finding out that it's a little more pronounced than we were aware of. Next slide. That's my presentation. Any questions?
The Access cards are just presented to the driver. There's no sort of...
They're required to present their handicap card and an ID. There was one other thing I wanted to talk about. This one of the scams. So we force them to show us their ID, and obviously, if the ID doesn't match to the Access card, then we take enforcement actions. One of the other scams with this is one that occurs on MetroLink quite frequently. Basically, some people with the disabled card can take a personal assistant with them, and that personal assistant gets to travel for free. So what you'll find is you'll have a disabled person with a legitimate card and have that and has that benefit, and they'll wait at a train station for somebody to come up and say, hey, you can travel for me and only pay me $5 versus paying the full fare. And then they'll come to L.A., and then they'll wait in L.A., and then they'll get somebody else, and they're making their living. So we've arrested a few of those guys as well, and we're working with Access to tighten up some of the rules for that. So it's a bit of a scam, but we're working on catching those guys.
ADA requirements are to permit a service. I mean, is it an ADA policy or is it a Metro policy?
It's up to the agency if they want to provide a free fare for the personal care assistant. Access is looking and working with those agencies to perhaps charge a nominal charge for those folks.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Kanabe.
When you say that, I mean, obviously it's not the assistant's fault. You know, I mean, I don't know why they'd want to charge something for them. If, I mean, that was the whole purpose of the policy, was to assist the disabled and their assistants. So. Because it's not the assistants that are selling the pen, right?
Well, they're conspirators as well. In the, am I correct?
It's only good for one. So if their assistant's not there, they couldn't sell that to someone for $5, correct?
Well, what they're doing is they're taking a stranger, and they're offering the stranger the ride into town.
I understand that. Yeah. But you also said that Access was looking at charging the assistant. The assistant is not the guilty party here, correct?
That's correct, yeah. Okay. I will pass your concerns back on to Access.
Right. That seems a little more time-consuming to uncover those sort of frauds than, you know, you didn't tap and what more. So, but anyway, it's an important part of cutting down on our losses and enforcing our policies and the law. So,
except in that particular case, it's not a loss. We wouldn't get the money anyway. Right. That's my point.
Right. I mean, I understand. Okay, if there's no other questions, thank you, Commander. I don't have any cards on this item. We will file and receive your report. Thank you. Item 41, please.
Conan Chung and Dana will provide the report.
All right, good afternoon. Conan Chung, DEO of Service Development. This report addresses one of the first items on the Title VI Environmental Justice Conformity Plan, which is to evaluate the Expo Phase 1 as well as the bus rail interface and service changes that were previously planned for December 2011 implementation that were not implemented at that time. Just to review, the Title VI evaluation really looks at determining if there are disparate adverse impacts from service changes. And if there are, then we must find the following. A significant agency goal or objective is addressed by the change, and all studied alternatives have greater adverse impacts than the recommended action. For environmental justice, the evaluation determines if there is a disproportionate adverse impact from service changes, and if so, are there any other mitigations that can be implemented in order to address the impacts? What we do is we follow the methodology that was previously presented today, and that has been reviewed by FTA. It is a methodology that looks at the impacts to travel time, which includes wait time, the walk access, and also the cost of the trip. When we look at the Expo Light Rail, we see that overall there are no disparate or disproportionate adverse impacts from the planned operation of Expo. And in fact, if you look at the travel time analysis, it does reduce the travel time somewhat significantly for all the various trip types that we evaluated. And in terms of cost, the cost is the same, if not cheaper, than the current alternative because Expo does provide a direct link where currently there are none. For the bus service changes, four of them did show disparate or disproportionate adverse impacts, and they all have to do with cost. And the reason for this is that they are changes that would truncate the lines to feed into Expo or discontinuation of lines because they are duplicative services. With the 439 and the extension of Route 217, again, patrons on Line 439 on the freeway portion would have to transfer and thus would have to incur an additional cost. This cost would only be incurred on cash-paying passengers because people with passes would not have to pay that additional cost. Shortening segments of Route 42 and 102, again, this is a similar situation where there is a disparate adverse impact on some cash-paying passengers, And again, it's because of the forced transfer. Discontinuation of line 305. Again, the riders on line 305 would transfer to other lines to complete their trips. And again, it would only impact cash-paying passengers as well. And then finally, shortening line 550 to Vermont and Exposition Boulevard. Again, the adverse impact is really related to the transfer requirement. So in conclusion, in summary, five of the changes were found to have no disparate or disproportionate adverse impacts. The four that were found to have impacts, it was found that each of these changes addresses a significant agency objective, which is really to improve the productivity of the system, to reduce duplication, better integrate bus and rail services, and to improve productivity. All studied alternatives resulted in greater adverse impacts than the recommended changes. For example, if we had to reinstate transfers, that would result in revenue loss to the agency, which would require us to reduce additional services. So the next steps, the equity evaluations presented in this report have been forwarded to FTA for review. As a side note, we have had conversations with FTA, and they're very pleased with our progress to date. They're actually impressed by the amount of effort we have taken to do this evaluation, and they're all positive comments coming back in terms of their support for our efforts. And then next, a record of the Board of Directors' consideration of the findings will be forwarded to FTA. And that concludes our presentation.
And just so I'm clear on this, the final approval then will come from the FTA as to these certifying the changes as being, I guess it's like an EIR, right? I mean that there's negative impacts, but there's overriding benefits that would justify them. Is that kind of the analysis that's done?
Okay. What FTA will approve is the methodology that we use for the evaluation. The final determination is made by this board as to whether or not there are disparate impacts or not.
Said another way, the FTA is not going to do schedule making for us, but they're going to make sure that we've applied the principles of a fair equity analysis to make sure that we haven't had a disparate impact that we didn't identify and address.
Yes.
Okay. So it'll come back to the board, but FTA will approve the fact-finding and the evaluation process that staff presents. So make sure that the board gets valid data so we can balance the equities.
We're also seeking approval of these sets of actions today by the committee, correct?
Right.
Yes.
Aside from the committee, I mean, just in terms of the larger scope is my comments.
Chair.
Director Huizan?
Yeah, so as I understand it, the FTA doesn't look at whether our overriding agency objective is a worthwhile one or not. They just look at the process and procedure and see if we dotted all our I's and crossed all our T's with respect to the process we're supposed to go through, but they don't evaluate whether, I mean, that's our decision to make, right, as a board.
Right.
Whether we agree that there is an overriding agency objective that will outweigh whatever disparate impact there is, correct?
Yes.
And so does this take effect after we hear back from FTA, or are we moving along the process to make these changes while FTA is looking, evaluating our submission?
Once the board makes the findings, unless there's a subsequent objection by FTA, we'd proceed with the service changes that have been evaluated.
Okay. And when do we hear from them?
We actually have heard from them. We did share this report with FTA.
Oh, we've already heard back from them.
Right, right. And they've been supportive of our efforts, and they've been very complimentary of our work to date.
Thank you.
Director Kanabe.
So, but as Director Huizar said, we still ultimately decide on that as it relates. I mean, they don't reroute, do they?
No,
they
don't.
They just, it's up or down on our changes.
Yes.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, so there's any number of variables here. What's the fare structure? What's the base fare? Are there zones? Are there transfers? How are the bus lines structured? Do you have short turns? Do you have a rail line? Do they interface with each other? What hours of service do you operate? What load standards do you apply? All of those are variables that we make the decisions on. What they want to make sure of is that whatever those policy decisions we make are applied in a way which is fair. Thus, the equity assessment, equity analysis of all these variables. Dan Levy, am I on the right track?
Yes.
Okay. Dan is, you recognize Dan, he's our expert in this issue area who's almost in weekly contact with FTA.
And obviously, as with any decision the board makes, there may be some who feel that we made the wrong decision. What is the appeal process or the alternative route for those who think that we did not balance the equities? Is it a lawsuit or is it a FTA review or what? I mean, just so we all know where the ultimate appeal or review could lie.
Good afternoon, Dan Levy. Once the board makes the determination, it goes to the FTA. They really, at that point, don't take any particular action. Someone can complain. They can file a complaint with the FTA, and the FTA would then do an investigation or come back and do another compliance audit. But there really isn't there's no ability for anybody to sue us over this report.
Okay.
No, anybody can sue anybody for anything, but that doesn't mean the FTA would hold in their favor. That's why we have public hearings here on these various projects. If we don't have a public hearing, that's a violation. So this board is the decision authority. And I should just point out in the context, we're going to be talking about next year's budget soon, but we're going to, you know, a few years out, we're going to have some fairly serious budget issues that will force us to re-examine issues of load standards and other service standards in order to have a budget that's in the black. So we're okay this year, but just a couple of years, we're going to be back on these issues.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Leahy. I have a member of the public wishing to speak, Sun Young Yang.
Good afternoon, committee. Sun Young Yang with the Bus Riders Union. I would urge this board to actually not move so hastily in approving this equity analysis. I know that, in fact, that there are still, Dan and the FTA are still in negotiation of the exact methodology of how to do these analysis. And we've also disputed around the methodology and, this does not capture system-wide impacts nor cumulative assessment of how these cuts are going to impact in the long run. And I think there's also disputes in terms of what constitutes a business necessity in the public interest and what is included in the option of less discriminatory alternatives. It seems like MTA needs to move beyond just budgetary rationalizing and options because at this point, with the reasoning that you're giving, the justification you're giving, any kind of budgetary reasoning justifies any kind of civil rights violation. And I think that reflects on the moral question of this agency. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Levy.
I feel compelled to say I will never advocate a civil rights violation based on a financial requirement of the MTA.
Mr. Chair.
Director Huizar.
And a point was raised by the speaker, which was my first question and later clarified. Initially, I thought you said that we've submitted these to the FTA. They're reviewing them, but we're still going forward with this action. But afterwards, it was clarified that we submitted them to FTA. They've agreed that we've done the proper procedure, and now we're moving forward with them, correct?
That's right.
Okay.
Under the terms of the compliance review that we had, everything that deals with the civil rights must be sent to the FTA before it comes to the board. So okay. When this was completed, we sent it to the FTA. They reviewed it. They were accepted it. They said it was a good piece of work, and they were happy with it. Now, the speaker mentioned that we're trying to develop a definitive methodology, and we are still negotiating with the FTA over what that would be, and so we may tweak exactly how we do these types of studies. But this one satisfied the FTA. The next step will be to the board.
So
the board take action, and then we would send a copy of their action to the FTA.
Gotcha. And the other issue that the speaker raised is the cumulative impacts. Number one, does FTA consider those types of impacts? And number two, even if they don't, where can we as a board get those, the cumulative impacts with the different route changes and cuts that we make? That is something that has been of concern for to this board for some time.
Well, in the in this morning's executive management committee, the group approved passing on to the board a proposed policy for how to determine what is a major service change. And it had two elements in it that looked at cumulative change. One was we'd have to look at 3 years' worth of service changes to make sure that it rose to the threshold that would require an equity review. So, for example, if we cut service on a particular route 10% this year and 10% next year, our standard is 25%, so we wouldn't do the equity review. But if in that third year it rose another 10% or another 10% cutback, it would surpass the 25% threshold, and so we would have to do the review. So we are looking at cumulative. That's not part of what we do now.
And before you go on, is that an FTA requirement or is that our own?
That's our own.
That's okay.
Originally, we went out for a public review of that policy when we were using a two-year period. And based on input from the Bus Riders Union and the service councils, we raised it to a three-year. And the second one is that we've added into our policy a system-wide requirement so that if services are reduced 20% system-wide, we would also do an equity review. And again, that's something that wasn't originally in the our first draft of this, but on input from the Bus Riders Union, we added that. They were more interested in a lower rate. We adopted 20%, which is the same rate that they use in the Bay Area and was approved, accepted by the FTA. So I think we're on pretty solid footing going forward to look at cumulative and system-wide impacts.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay. If there are no objections, and I don't have any other cards, if there are no objections, this item will be approved, item 41. Thank you. Item 42.
I'll move approval of item 42.
Approving the Vanpool lease program, a very successful program.
Absolutely.
42 has been moved and seconded. No speaker cards with no objection. 42 is so approved.
I'll move 43 for the purchase of the buses.
43. Bus procurement.
Including the findings as included in the staff report.
This is issuing a RFP for a different, for up to 900 transit buses.
The question I had on 43 was, what is that section 130232 that does not constitute a procurement method adequate for Metro's needs? Well, just answer that question. I don't.
130232 is the competitive bid statute, and the 20217 is competitive negotiation. So if the board finds that...
this section allows you what, the sole source?
Not sole source, competitively negotiate versus,
Competitive
bids.
RFI versus RF?
Yes.
Okay.
RFP.
Bid?
Versus low bid.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? I have no cards. It's been moved and seconded. With no objection, 43 is approved. 44.
Thank you.
Can I just, on 44, Mr.
Yes, Chairman? Director Knabe.
I don't know if there's any controversy over this. I just want you to know, I don't think there's any program that this agency does that provides a better service to the people on the road than this towing service. I was on the 405 yesterday in two separate incidents, and being able to access those towing folks within minutes to alleviate, it's just one of the great programs that we do.
Thank you, sir. I have with me John Takahashi, who actually runs that program, so I wanted him to have a chance to be in front of you. The
hurry up, they want to vote.
People make stuff work.
They want to vote.
On item 44, staff wanted to note that we have received two protests on this award. The staff is going to recommend that you approve the item subject to resolution of the protests.
So, I mean, have the protests been resolved?
They have not yet. One of them just came in. Both are being investigated. But we would like you to authorize the CEO to award the contracts. And if the protests are adjudicated and the bids are responsive at lowest, then they will be mixed into the mix appropriately.
So it's appropriate to award based on that? I mean, what happens?
You're authorizing the CEO.
You're not going to award to the two protests. In other words, if something happens and the protests are upheld, you can't go back on an award.
Well, the award would be you're authorizing the CEO to award subject to resolution of the two protests. You're not awarding today. You're just authorizing them to. Once the two protests are adjudicated, they'll be mixed in.
You comfortable with that, Mr. Attorney?
Okay. I'm very comfortable with that. That's a routine practice amongst the legal community. Director
sounds like Bill Blowers, isn't he?
Thank you. I do have two speakers, Moshe Ben Dayan, followed by Robert Ring.
Good afternoon. I'm Moshe Ben Dayan. I own Tip Tap Toe Service. And I'm here to speak on how great this program is. I agree with you. And I do operate the 405 freeway. I'm just here to say that I think the fact that they increased the requirements for this program, for this procurement, it's something that I am welcome because it's going to increase the quality of the operators. So I welcome that, and I want to encourage the MTA to continue to raise the requirements. That way you're going to have more qualified operators. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next speaker is Mr. Ring, Robert Ring.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Ring. I'm an attorney for L.A. Bestway Towing, and we are protesting the suggestion for the awards for beats 6 and 9. L.A. Bestway Towing is the lowest qualified bidder. L.A. Bestway Towing has been towing successfully for the FSP since 1993. They have never been suspended, terminated, and have never failed to qualify. And they're the only black-owned minority company in the system. What happened here? What happened was L.A. Bestway Towing sent in their application for a motor carrier permit to the Department of Motor Vehicles. They have a copy of that. They had a check with it. The check was cashed. DMV didn't issue a motor carrier permit. That is what happened. So for quite a few months, they did not have a motor carrier permit. They were unaware of that. When they became aware of that, they immediately FedExed another check. It caused them to be suspended by CHP for an entire 2 hours. This was last March. So from last March till today, their trucks have still been servicing FSP. The FSP program did not suspend them, did not terminate them because of this, and their trucks are out there today. The FSP says that they don't qualify.
Thank you. And I'm sure those concerns will be raised and highlighted in the protest and taken under consideration by the appropriate staff.
Thank you for the committee's attention. You can be certain of that. Thank you very much. And we're proud to be part of that program, everyone says, is great. Thank you.
Thank you. Success has many fathers.
I'll second.
Thank you. Director Huizar. Okay, we have a motion and a second to approve the item subject to the protests as explained by Mr. Phelan. With no objection, such will be our decision. Item 45.
Good afternoon, Conan Chung, DEO Service Development. Back in March, the board approved the June 2011 service changes, and with that, they requested that staff come back on a periodic basis to evaluate what actually happened after the fact. What we did was we evaluated the June service changes over the last quarter compared to the quarter prior to that, and we looked at items such as load standards, making sure that they're maintained, making sure that riders from certain lines that were discontinued actually were able to migrate to adjacent services. We wanted to ensure the time connections for low-frequency services were met. We reviewed customer complaints to make sure that we didn't have a significantly high amount of additional customer complaints. And then we looked at line productivity in terms of boardings per hour to make sure that those were maintained as well. In summary, what we found out was overall, riders have responded to the service changes as we anticipated. Just as an example, we reduced about 4% of the system, which is about 250,000 hours. However, based on that reduction, we only lost less than 1% of ridership. And what that means is that we really reduced service that wasn't really being utilized. As a result, the productivity of our system increased by 4% from 51 passengers per hour to 53 passengers per hour.
And as a note, when we came to the board back in March, we were anticipating that the productivity would go to 54 passengers an hour, so we're well on our way towards that objective. Again, in comparison, if you look at our system compared to other large peer agencies, our average of the peer agencies come in at about 55 passengers an hour. So even when we're at 53 passengers an hour, we're still lower in terms of productivity, but we're moving towards that system-wide average. We continue to coordinate efforts to improve better better time connections, and any complaints that we get, we make sure that we look into them and address them as needed. And that concludes my presentation.
Okay. Thank you. Do I have any cards on this item? Have we developed a standard throughout our course of operations? We are going to be adjusting lines, cutting lines, or adding. Have we set a agency standard where a certain level of productivity meets the threshold as to what's acceptable and what isn't? You said we've got a 4% increase in productivity, a 1% reduction in ridership. Is there something that we can quantify, or do you suggest we just take it on a adjustment-by-adjustment basis to evaluate whether it's appropriate or not?
No, we have certain standards that are set. The load standard, of course, is set at 1.3. System-wide productivity, we do want to see it increase. Again, if we look at the average of our peers, which includes Chicago and New York and so on and so forth, they're averaging about 55 passengers an hour. We're right now about 53 passengers an hour, so we've actually improved from 51, which is where we were before the service changes. We're not quite at the average yet, which means that we still do have some opportunities out there on the system, but we are trending in the positive direction. The board also...
Let me just add to that. We do have policy standards which we're not following.
We're too relaxed.
Under board direction, there's a number of lines that should be trimmed back or canceled, which have not been. Amongst these biggest systems, the six biggest systems, we have the lowest fare box return, the lowest loads, and the lowest fares, the lowest base fare. We basically are in a position which is not sustainable beyond the next couple of years. So the load ratio here of 1.3 is amongst the lowest in the world. Much more typical is about a 1.5 or higher on bus lines. So this is independent of me. It's independent of anybody in this room. It's not this year, but two or three years out, we will face a serious economic crisis.
Director Fasano.
You know, at this point, nothing's going to happen that's going to ease that crisis. It'll probably get worse. But I'm also, maybe I'm guessing here, but I'm presuming our passenger miles may be higher than some of these other agencies due to the sprawl in our system. Is that correct?
I don't know. I mean, the average trip length is only 4 miles or something.
Yeah, like average that. Trip length is fairly short. It's 4 miles, a little less than that. On the rapid system, it's a little longer. Rail, obviously, is longer. It's about 6 miles or so.
So is that comparable to the other agencies we've discussed?
We'd have to take a look.
Okay.
I don't know that right now.
Thank you.
I think that, take Minneapolis, I can speak from. They have a much more white-collar ridership, a much more suburban ridership. So they probably have a longer average trip length. This is very urban, much more like Manhattan or Chicago. We'll be discussing in the coming years with you load ratios and fares. And, you know, if we behave in a business-like fashion as regards those two variables, we will be fine. We will be sustainable for the long term. If we continue to keep those figures low, then we're going to hit very, very rough financial sailing. Not this year, but it's coming. Conrad, I didn't mean to get you off your track.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, the final statement I was going to make is that we do have a transit service policy that does set all the guidelines and service standards and criteria, and that is a board-adopted policy, and we're actually bringing the update to this board, I believe, in the next month.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from the board, from the committee? If not, this is a receive and file with no objection. We will receive it and file it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next item is 46.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am John Hilmer. I am Director of Metro Service Councils. I've had the pleasure of the last 2 years working with all of the five Metro Service Councils. While their primary mission is to review proposed service changes to our bus system and approve them or deny them or modify them, they also receive reports on the quality of our bus service on a monthly basis, not only the system, but the quality of the bus service within their region. Today I'm going to be talking about results of the August motion by the board that was put forward by Mayor Vito Gosa, directing the CEO to establish an internal compliance manager to evaluate the quality of our service, evaluate report on that service. This is the first quarterly report that I'll be providing that actually has a significant amount of data in it. We're looking at 8 different quality service measures as well as a new quarterly survey. So I'll be relatively quick going through here. I will ask that the council or the committee take a look at the attachment A, and we'll follow through on all of those measures of service quality. The first one is the on-time performance for Metro bus service. Generally speaking, Metro bus service on-time performance has been showing an improvement, sort of a steady improvement. They've reached 76% in December, and I just received the January numbers, and it's improved up to 78.6% on time for January. That happens to be the best on-time performance for the system for at least the past 5 years, maybe even longer than that. So there's a steady improvement. In addition to that, operations has formed a committee to take a look at bus lines that have a history of poor on-time performance and developing ways to improve them. An example of that is line 720, the Wilshire Rapid Line. Its on-time performance over the last 5 years has been below 65%. They've implemented some actions, and the on-time performance in January has gone up a bit to 72%. Moving to the next page, which would be the customer complaint rate. This is one where we're having there's some difficulty. It has been showing a trend that has been going in an upward direction. Approximately 22% of the complaints that we receive from our bus side deal with pass-ups. Of interest is the West Side Service Sector, or Council, which goes from North Los Angeles all the way to the Pacific Ocean, has the lowest complaint rate, and yet it has many of the service qualities that don't generate high-quality service. Indicates that the frequency of service is very important for the quality of the service as well. Moving on to the next page, bus reliability. This indicates that there has been a steady and consistent improvement in the reliability of our bus service. It continues to improve, and in fact, it reached 4,000 miles between mechanical road call in December, and again, continues to show a general and consistent improvement. We move on to the next page, page 4 of the attachment. Bus cleanliness. The cleanliness of a bus is extremely important to the agency. It conveys to our customers and to the general public that the agency is well run and, more importantly, well worth their support. It also conveys to our employees that the quality of the customer service we provide is very important. We have been showing a steady increase in the rating of our bus cleanliness. And for January, which is not on your chart, we've gone up a little bit more to 8.5, which is, again, a continuation of the improvement of the cleanliness of our bus system. If we take a look quickly at graph number 5, page 5, that deals with our bus accident rate. This is moving up slightly as well. That's a negative trend. That's one of the two negative trends that we have. This is a little surprising given the effort that transportation has been putting into reducing the accident rate. All accidents go into an internal review board where we have the management, a supervisor, and a line instructor. A line instructor is a bus operator who's been trained to be an instructor. They evaluate all accidents. That gives them an opportunity, even though the accidents may not be the operator's fault, to give them sort of tips and keys on how to do better and reduce it. Anecdotally, one reason we may have a slight increase in our accident rate numbers is we have an incident-based surveillance system on all of our buses, so that if a bus exceeds a certain G-force, it will record 30 seconds of a video. There may be accidents that in the past operators may not have reported because it may have been simply bumping into something. Today, they're reporting those accidents because they definitely don't want to be charged with not reporting an accident if that video shows up on the manager's desk. Let's move on to item 6, which is our percentage of passenger standees. That has gone up a bit, but we moved from a 1.2 to a 1.3 load standard. A load standard is the formula that the scheduling department uses to determine how many trips should be on a line. 1.3 indicates that at the peak load point of a bus line, we schedule for up to 30% of the riders standing on the bus. That is a relatively low standard. In fact, Long Beach, Big Blue Bus, their standard is 1.5. Metro's standard prior to the consent decree was up to 1.45, so it's a relatively low standard. You'll see on the bottom line of that graph, we're averaging about 3 to 4% of our trips over the 30% load factor. That actually may indicate that we have excess service in here. Again, if you're scheduling for a number up to 1.3, chances are you're going to have a scattering of those buses that are going to be above it. 3% or 4% is actually a very, very small number based upon some of our historical trends. Page number 7, this is a brand-new program. We're evaluating and scoring the cleanliness of 20 of our bus stations. These are our most active bus stations. The evaluations are done monthly by a combination, actually teamwork, by Metro staff and 15 volunteers from our service councils who will evaluate each station based on 33 criteria on a scale of 1 to 10. We're at 7.64 for the average for the months of December and January. We have 5 stations that are exceeding 8.4, and we have 3 stations that are below 7. There's been progress made in terms of cleanliness. When these evaluations are completed, they're given to our facilities maintenance department, as well as photos where there's certain items that need to be taken care of. And we've been having a nice response from the facilities maintenance, stops and zones, and other departments to rectify deficiencies that may be noted and determined. And then let's move on again fairly quickly to our ADA compliance. These are ADA issues. This chart on page 8 is simply the number of customer complaints that we receive that are ADA related. That's pass-ups, fare issues, and others related to ADA. We're averaging a little less than 40 a month. That's a pretty small number given the 32 million riders that board our system on an average month. We don't have an excellent way or even an acceptable way of determining how many people with disabilities are actually boarding our buses. We know how many people board in a wheelchair, but we don't necessarily know how many people board in a walker or a cane or visual impairments. So this is a kind of a rough measure for that. More reflective would be the next charts where we're using the Mystery Rider Program. You heard about this just a little while ago. That's where we contract for a company to provide us with around 200 to 220 undercover rides a month, evaluate the quality of the service in a variety of manners. On page 9, this is the percent of wheelchair pass-ups that are observed. For the past 9 months, we're averaging about 0.5% of the trips were observed passing a wheelchair. Now, it may have been a pass-up that was unavoidable. If the operator had 2 wheelchairs on the bus already, the operator will still stop, supposed to stop, and explain to the passenger who's waiting that they couldn't take them. They contact the operator contacts the control center, who determines when the next bus will be there, and if it's more than 30 minutes, they would dispatch a bus to pick up that wheelchair passenger. Nonetheless, 0.5% is still above our goal and our target. The graph below that is the deployment of the ramp or the lift for a person who is not in a wheelchair but still needs it, a walker, cane, or somebody with a disability. Here for the last 6 months, we've been averaging about 98% compliance with that rule. Then we'll move over to page 8, I'll go the other way. This is the last one of the ADA. This is the internal automated voice annunciator. It announces the stops as the bus is approaching. If that system is down, the operator is to call out the major stops. The combination of that, we're showing about a 95% compliance over the last 9 months. That probably needs to go up a little bit more to be in full compliance. And then finally, there's an addendum to this report, which is our first quarterly passenger survey. This was actually done with a great deal of vigor and support from Cosette Stark and Jeff Boberg of the Transportation Programs and Development Group of Communications. We're doing quarterly surveys to augment the annual survey. And the annual survey will be coming up in April. The annual surveys, we do 18,000 to 20,000 completed surveys. The quarterly surveys are around 27,000. So this is the very first one, kind of sets the standard for it. I'll just hit a few highlights on that. 88% of the passengers who were surveyed felt safe on the bus. 82% felt safe at the bus stop. That's actually not a very wide spread. You'd expect it maybe to be higher. Is the bus clean? 82% said they generally felt the bus was clean, and 74% felt the stop was clean. We did have 28% of the passengers reporting being passed up by a bus in the past month. 13% said they had a bus that had a breakdown in the last month. Those are relatively high for us. Then on 13 specific items that were in the mayor's motion was how long does it take somebody to get to their bus stop? It's about 11 and a half minutes on average, with 71% of the passengers saying that it was 10 minutes or less. How long did they wait? Here we have, again, about 11 and a half minute wait time on average. 70% in this case said they waited 10 minutes or less for a bus. That's not a very bad finding on that. If we turn the page, you'll see that 77% of our riders have a cell phone, and 39%, almost 40% of our riders have a smartphone. So they're well connected. Who are our riders? 21, low income. 50% of our riders have annual household family incomes of under $15,000. So they're relatively poor. Also, heavily minority. 91% of our riders come from a self-designated minority. That's high. However, I have to keep in mind that L.A. County in and of itself is a minority-majority county. 72% of county residents as of 2010 were also a minority. Finally, of the surveys that we had completed, 35% were completed in Spanish, 65% were completed in English. The individuals who did not understand either English or Spanish were given a card in 9 other languages that gave them directions how to fill out the form online at Metro. And as I understand it, we had 7 of those completed online. And then the list of bus lines that were surveyed, there was at least 3 in each of the 5 regions. And with that, that completes my report.
Thank you. Director Fasana.
Yes, just a few comments. The high use of phones and cell phones and smartphones, you know, mirrors other stats that I've seen, and I think it certainly leads to opportunities in terms of how we address things like next bus or next trip, and, you know, really dealing directly with the information of the phones rather than a lot of equipment on the platforms themselves. So I think it's something we can consider. The enunciators, I mean, I agree that violation ought to be at 0 for that, so I'd be curious what our plan is to encourage that. Obviously, monitoring standees and some of these other factors will be important as well. The other thing, too, and I don't know if we need it every month, but I'd really like some comparative data in terms of how we rank with some of the other systems nationwide, maybe Orange County as well, just to get a sense of, you know, it's one thing to see how we measure against ourselves internally, but to the extent the data is comparable, what's happening with other systems, that information would be helpful. Thank you.
We can sure do that. I mean, I can, you know, if we look at the 6 biggest in the country, we'll get a certain picture. If we look at smaller systems, we'll get a very different picture. The bus operators in Orange County who are the happiest are those who used to work in Los Angeles because the streets are in better condition and the loads are less. The problem that we confront is that we cannot afford that. We can't afford what we have today. We can certainly provide the data, but we face a profound issue in the near term of sustainability. But we'll do as you ask.
Well, maybe we need a grading system for jurisdictions with good or bad roads and what they do to our systems. I'm sure we'd all anxiously look forward to seeing that data.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Are there any cards on this? These are. This is a receive and file. Thank you for your good work, and it's a great way for us to keep our pulse on how we're doing from the customer standpoint. With no objection, this report has been received. Item 47.
Mr. Chair, I introduced this motion, and we heard this already in committee. I would ask that if we could receive and file this report. However, I understand there's an existing RFP out for a renewal of the red light cameras that we will get the results at our board meeting in May. I'm still troubled, and I'm probably one of few on the board that I just don't think that we're that these cameras serve their purpose as we think they should. The data we get is we show that there are red light cameras. They've been there for a while, and year to year how accidents have decreased. But we don't know if they're directly attributed to the red light cameras or other things. I think we need additional information that could really make that connection on how these red light cameras are making those intersections safer. I would hope we could get that information by the time the new contract comes to the board. I've heard from my colleagues on this board that, you know, cost is an issue, but it's not as much of an issue, that the priority is safety. At the same time, when the city decided to disband its red light camera program, recognizing that a lot of the issued citations were unenforceable, you saw a lot of people beginning not to pay them, even the ones issued for MTA infractions or the ones where we have them. So when you have that going on and there's less and less people paying for them, is it really serving its purpose as a deterrent? Cameras are supposed to deter people, but they see a camera now. They say it's not enforceable. The word is out there. Are they really serving their purpose? I know we have a lot in today's agenda. I don't want to get into the into detail about this. As a maker of the motion, I am going to ask to receive and file. But those are the types of issues and questions, a more detailed analysis as to the real, if they serve increased safety, if we could get that type of information before we renew the next contract.
We will do that, Director Wezar. I think the assessment on whether or not the city's decision, what is the impact of the city's decision on Metro's program, it's too early to determine that, and we will be coming back to the board in May to make that assessment, because we need, as I mentioned at my last presentation last month, we just need additional time to find out, are the people who are being cited using Metro's red light photo enforcement cameras, are they paying the citations? Are they simply ignoring them? Are they going to court to contest the citation? And if they are going to court, how many of those that are going to court end up being either dismissed by the Superior Court judge or being upheld by the judge? So that information is forthcoming. As you mentioned, we will be preparing that report in May, and we'll be coming back to the board with a recommendation.
So in addition, Director, the effect of the city's decision, we're going to measure its effect on our violation and our accident rates also. That, in addition to what Vijay just spoke about, will be included in our presentation in the May board. We're not coming here in May to specifically say, here's the contract award, we're going to award it to X company. We're coming back with this information and whether to continue with photo enforcement or not. It is a yay or nay decision.
Okay.
We might come back in June with the contract award if we decide to continue with the enforcement program.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
And also, if I could add, come back with the information on which Superior Court judges or commissioners are dismissing these tickets. I understand that's part of that was part of LA's decision, is that they weren't getting enforced anyway. But come back, when you come back, give us some of that information on the judicial side of the equation, as well as the cost neutrality. I know the report says it's very difficult to find out how it goes, but if there's any other indication you can give us, even an educated guess, so we can weigh that factor as well when we decide.
We will do that.
Anything, Director Fasano? Anything further? Okay, moved and seconded. No public comment cards. We have received this and we'll await your further information.
Thank you.
Next item, please, is item 48. Thank you. Mr. Raymond.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Matt Raymond. This item is in response to a motion from Director Najarian on bringing back a report on the Clipper card and the light validators used up in Northern California. Just to give you an overview, the photograph on your right is actually one of their light validators. This is mounted in multiple systems up in the Bay Area. It's not only in their bus vehicles, it's also on their rail system. on the Muni Rail system. These actually started to go into installation back in 2001. I think ATC was the very first one to get them. And it was under the banner of TransLink. TransLink is a program that obviously started in 2001, had a very similar path to TAP. In 2009, it was rebranded as the Clipper card, so a lot of the infrastructure was already put into place. And it includes ATC, Muni, BART, VTA, SamTrans, Caltrain, Golden Gate Transit, as well as the ferry system. The system in the Bay Area uses stored value. They are also loading some of their local fare products on there as well, too. But what they have is they have participation is required in these programs by these different entities. The keys to the Clipper card, and what the photograph is here, is when you put on a light validator, there's various components that go with it. So it does not require a full fare box, which is what the attraction of these light validators are, but there are add-on components that go with it. And depending on the functionality you want in a light validator, will determine the type of light validator that's selected. The keys to the Clipper program were basically twofold. One was that the MTC, which is the funding agency up there, basically required participation by all the different agencies that were in place, and actually enacted some state law which would have funding implications if they didn't participate. The second thing was their approach to a transfer policy, which is different than ours. Our current transfer policy, basically you collect the transfer on your first boarding. What they do in the Bay Area is they collect the transfer on the second boarding, and this technology allows you or enables the system to know that if somebody's already paid a full fare, that when they board the next vehicle, that they only are required to pay a transfer, so it adjusts the funds accordingly or the fare accordingly. In terms of where we are with TAP readers, the images you have up there, basically there is we currently have light validators in operation up in Santa Clarita, and there's several types, but the one in Santa Clarita are used in their Dial-A-Ride system. We're in the process of installing them on the LADOT system right now. That should be done in about a year. And for us to do this, the big determining factor for us is, just speaking in gross terms of dollars, a lower-end unit costs about $2,000. And for that, for us to go that route, we would have to make we would want to make policy transfer policy decisions in advance. If you have want more functionality, those units cost between $5,000 and $6,000, and this is again per vehicle, and they would have greater functionality, but again at a higher cost. So if the more that we can determine up front, the better we can determine the equipment that would be required. But this is a very viable option for the smaller operators in the system. There still obviously are costs involved. There's still system costs involved. But if the goal is to have the entire region TAP enabled, this is definitely a path forward. It's one that is used up in Northern California by the Clipper system, and something that we could pursue here as well too. Another part of the motion was basically to report back on participation by the operators, the local operators in terms of the region. And this was what we presented back in November, and it showed that we had seven agencies that currently are participating. If we fast forward to this month, Gardena, who actually is going live on the 19th, so by the end of this month, they will be in full tapper operation, as well as ASI. System, they've been very successful in terms of rolling out dual cards that not only work on the TAP-enabled operators, but they also work on the taxi system as well, too, and they use the TAP Visa system to do that. So that completes my report, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any comments by directors?
Just, I look forward to seeing this system fully implemented before it's obsolete and retired.
Okay.
Nice. Yes. Second that.
Director Huizar?
Yeah, Mr. Short, thank you very much. And as we all know, the board has been focused on making sure that we do more with our current TAP system, and we've invested millions to make it work. And as you mentioned in our presentation, San Francisco's implementation of their version of TAP, they yielded about a 96% countywide operators who are using the system, and that's not the case here for us. And our mayor and chair of the board currently recently met with some municipal partners reviewing their issues, and he spent significant time there talking about those issues. Now, the report states that a regional mandate is necessary for municipal operators to participate in the TAP program. However, what our mayor and our chair heard quite clearly, and they also stated in a letter that they sent to us, the municipal operators are saying that all we really need is better integration and cooperation, and that the burden, the onus, is on us to fix that, that we don't need to go to get additional legislation, that all we need to do is really move forward and correct what's before us. What we really need to do is have our CEO work with our departments, get them to talk to one another, and get a better approach to how we could get some more of our municipal operators. They want to use a TAP system. They want to get involved, but they feel that we're not doing our end of the job to make that possible. So I would entertain, as our mayor has recommended in a letter of February 7th, a motion to establish a working group comprised of six municipal operators, of which three are TAP-enabled and three that are not TAP-enabled, along with high-level executive MTA staff, to address the seven overarching items identified in the municipal operator letter dated January 30th, 2012, and see if we could get a report to the March board meeting, if that would be amenable to our...
I'll second for discussion. My follow-up on that I would like to see is, I also think at some point what's on us is to really determine, you know, and again as an advocate of the munis as well, but at some point there needs to be some vision of what a seamless system is going to look like. And as the funder of the system and the provider of most of the service in the county and the agency that probably links with just about every muni that's out there, it probably falls on us, whether we want to accept it or not, to really kind of get the sense of what that seamless fare structure might look like. And I think determining what those rules would be and then giving people a chance to come in with that or to stay out of it. But I think in some sense, for this to really be successful, there probably needs to be somewhat of a countywide fare structure for rides that do overlap the various providers. And this agency probably is in the position of having to set those rules and determine them. And I know that maybe there's a way with this system to where for trips to stay entirely within a muni's jurisdiction that don't overlap with other providers, maybe they can have their own fare rules. But I think working out the issues of transfers and a countywide seamless system, I think a lot of that will come back to this board. And I guess I would look to see what this task force would recommend in terms of what needs to be done to really set up and what types of decisions need to be made, even if there isn't a recommendation on exactly what the final structure should be. But what types of things do we need to finally come to grips with to set that system and that standard?
Thank you. I applaud the mayor and his staff for conducting the outreach and expending the effort and energy to get in touch with the munis. You know, we have a history with the munis. We've got this whole apportionment. What do you call it? Not the apportionment. What's the formula that we're always fighting over?
The FAP.
FAP.
The FAP, and there's the eligible and the included. And clearly, you know, we are we're in the same game with them. But we need them to get on board with us. And there is no doubt in my mind that if we put our minds to this, and the mayor's efforts were a great start to bring everyone together to find out what it is, and I haven't read their letter, which contains these seven concerns, but whatever they may be, there's no reason why we can't, as a dynamic and vibrant agency led by such a distinguished board. You thought I was going to say CEO, didn't you?
I did, too. I did.
I thought you were going to say
that we can't give the proper direction to Mr. Leahy, who knows the abilities of all the staff, and clearly I think everyone would like this thing to work. We're very tired, speaking for myself, of having this been around for so many years. Let's just get down to it, put the appropriate personnel, get the appropriate parties at the table, and make it work. We can do it. I think we're well on the way to having it done, but it just takes a lot of cooperation and a lot of trust and a lot of fine-tuning and listening, which apparently that's what the mayor's session was. I didn't attend, but I'm sure he did a lot of listening to all the muni operators who have other issues with the MTA as well, but as it comes to this TAP program, I'm sure they were very clear as to what their issues were. I support this motion to form the subcommittee or the working group, as explained by Director Huizar, and I'm sure supported by the chair, to get this thing going. And let's just get this thing out. It's going to help the entire region in our transportation needs, and it'll be great for everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as written here on our monitor, that's the motion's correct. I would just add that we have the CEO report back at the March board meeting with an update. Oh, there it is. Okay.
Can I ask for April? The March board reports are due in like 2 days or something. So
I was thinking the same thing, but unless you said something, I was going to leave it. But yeah, you're right.
I'll tell you what. Why don't I give you? I'll give you an oral report in March. And then we'll do a written in April, if that's satisfactory.
Well, maybe in March, if there's not activity, you could report on your direction and your plan of approach and all this, and sure. Report to the board what you plan to do.
But again, I expect that there are different rules that everyone has, and at some point there may need to be some decisions made by this board. So I kind of like those issues identified, too. Where we reached consensus? Yep. Where didn't we? Where would a decision made here, what would be the benefits and what would be the issues, so we can figure out what we need to do?
You know, I appreciate what you're saying. I mean, it's fairly extraordinary to think that we embarked on this program without an agreement, without an agreement as to goals or purpose or objectives. There's no charter agreement. We embarked on a very large, very complex program. As regards fare systems, my sense is that we sought to build a system, a computer system, that could absorb and incorporate all these different fare systems, so we didn't, in fact, confront any fare policy issue. We just incorporated 25 different designs into the software. So that led to increasing complexity and cost of the system. So we have built, remember the Rube Goldberg thing? Well, that's what we've done here. And so, but I take the challenge of going the next step to try to achieve that which we can. If there's some system that doesn't want to be involved, well, we need to go forward and get the utility out of this investment, and as best we can, I'll be happy to proceed as the resolution describes.
Okay.
Thank you. I have a public speaker, Worth Baker.
Worth Baker. Yeah, I was actually up in the Bay Area for a retreat at Berkeley, and so I took the transit system from SFO, and then I actually went back to Oakland to fly back the same day, and it was pretty interesting how they have it set up. I was wondering, with the light validators, I guess there's different cost levels. Do any of them read, like, cell phones, Matt? Do you know offhand if that's possible or not that you know?
Not right now, no.
Okay. And then my other thing is, currently with a TAP, you can only buy TAP passes at machines. You can't do it online. You can't just renew your thing online. Is that correct?
No, you can buy them online.
Oh, you can? Okay. I guess I'll have to look into that. Thanks.
Thank you. Very good. We have an item before us, moved and seconded. If there's no objections, the motion is approved, as well as receiving the report that we're presenting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item, 49.
Matt. Oh, can you switch to the... Another component. Gate locking. This report is on the results for the gate locking demonstration that's been taking place over the last several months. We began in September. We just completed our testing of 10 different stations in January. We conducted over 20 tests overall during the peak and as well as the off-peak. And we actually registered over 26,000 gate entries. We recorded their entrance into the system. This slide is basically to give you an idea of and it was actually reported on earlier by the sheriff as well, one of the biggest issues we have is when you compare locked versus unlocked environment is that our customers are not currently tapping. So the pie chart on the left basically shows you 74%. This is just an example of one station, but shows you 74% of the entries in an unlocked environment they're not tapping. This does not mean that they don't have valid fare media. It just means they're not tapping to get through the gates. If you look at the locked environment, what this shows you is 100% population of data in terms of entry information. So it shows you a breakdown of how of the numbers of people getting through the gates by the different fare types. So as an example, 18% for the day pass, 30%, I mean 25% for the 30-day, as well as 23 for the one-way. So it gives you us a much better idea of the people going through our system. Also, as part of this test, we identified people who are not currently on tap, such as Metrolink, Access Services. Well, Access Services is now on tap. Easy Pass, which is a paper pass, and to get full counts of that as well too. So this just shows you before in a locked in an unlocked environment versus in a locked environment. The difference in terms of fare media going through our system. This gives you a percentage breakdown as well as a quantity breakdown of the 26,000 entries we recorded. 27% were the 30-day passes, 26% were one-ways, 14% day passes, 11% 7 days. Another key part of this is Metrolink. And just so you guys know, too, this system was only done, these tests were only done on the subway, which is the red and the purple line, where we have connections with Metrolink, which accounted for 8% of our total transactions. Miscellaneous Metro transactions equated to 7%. And then Easy and Access were 4 and 3. And then actual interagency transfers, we thought this would be higher, but it was less than a percent. Actually, out of 26,000 gate entries, it was only 17 total. But that gives you a breakdown. In terms of, I keep double-clicking. In terms of, just to give you an idea, Metrolink, we broke down the 8% on half of the people who came through to find out what the breakdown was in terms of the fare media they were using, and found out that only 11% are round-trip or one-way, and the lion's share of Metrolink boardings are on either monthly passes or the 10-trip or weekly passes. So it just gives us an idea of what we're dealing with in terms of the Metrolink customer. In terms of a breakdown of our system, we project about 60% of our customers are tap-enabled. In other words, they have some type of tap fare media that can get them through the lock gates if necessary. 20% are metro fare media that either is paper coming out of our ticket machines or some other type of fare media that are non-tap. And then we have 20% that are external non-tap. So if you break down our overall boardings, it just gives you an idea of in terms of moving to a 100% tap environment, where we have to go. This slide, all it is it's another example. It's Normandy Station, and this just gives you an example of every time we lock the gates, there it does have an impact in terms of ticket vending machine activity. So the four bars that are higher, and we actually even had one rainy day, it just shows that because most of the tests we were doing were on one individual day, so we wanted to see if it reoccurred in terms of TVM activity and sales activity. And so we found that at Normandy Station, where we did four tests, that there was increases on each of the days that the gates were locked. I keep jumping ahead here. In terms of another big thing we look at in terms of the fare media, a lot of the fare media that goes through our system is already prepaid, like a 7-day or a 30-day rolling pass. The key activity that takes place at our ticket machines are for day passes as well as the single-trip tickets. And so what we did here was we broke down gate entries versus TVM revenue. So when you look at gate entries, 60% of our entries are some type of other fare media other than single rides or day passes. But when you look to TVM revenue, basically over 60% of our or close to 60% of our activity, or of our TVM activity, is for day passes and single trips. So in other words, what that means is people have passes coming into the station, prepaid fare media coming into the station. They can get through our system, but in terms of our TVM activity, that's where we're seeing it in terms of buying the single trips and the day passes, or a big majority of it. In terms of real revenue impacts, one of the things that the study showed us basically is that there are increases, but we wanted to look at the larger stations where we have high transfer activity, high volumes of customers. And what we basically found is there was, in terms of revenue impacting, and this isn't the boardings, but this is the impact on our ticket vending machines, that at 7th Street Metro we had an 18% increase in TVM activity, and North Hollywood we had a 22%. The other thing to take into consideration here, though, is that TVMs account for about $35 million $1 million a year in terms of revenue, which is less than 10% of our total system revenue. So if you look at the total system, if you were to take 20% as an average increase, that equates to about $7 million in revenue for the entire system, and about $4 million if you were to lock down the subway. And that's just based on a 20% increase in TVM revenue in those stations. So it gives you an idea of the impact of locking in terms of looking at a projection. In terms of steps going forward, some of that was mentioned as part of the previous item. But basically, we're in the process of converting our ticket vending machines. We've been doing that for a while. The next stage is looking at the single tickets as well as the day passes. The other area is easy transit passes, which are currently paper passes, Metrolink conversion, and that's something we're working with them as well, too. We have to look at the security and assistance camera installation. Mentioned earlier in the previous report was transfer policies, how we're going to deploy our officers, our LASD officers, as well as customer outreach and training. And then also, if you look at some of our systems, especially like in 7th Street, we have to look at where our SAVs or our standalone validators are located within our system. We might want to relocate some of those to have better passenger flow for gating. So that concludes my report, and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Yes, thank you. This study reveals some very interesting facts, and one that jumps out at me is that when the gates are locked and people are forced to use a tap card or ticket, we see a 68% rise in tickets purchased, and that's a pretty huge increase. And that is contrary or conflicts with what the sheriff department estimates are people who do fare evasion. I wanted to first understand that. I think the sheriff department estimates that there are 3-5% that evade fare. So what is this contradiction between what we see in this report and what the sheriff reports?
Well, that was the reason why we showed the larger stations. Yeah. 68%, when we were doing our tests, we were doing smaller stations, single access points, off-peak, so you're going to have a different behavior at that time versus other times. If you look at the lion's share of our boardings, they happen at about 6 stations on our subway system, and that's where we're going to have the most activity. That's also where you're going to have your highest level of commuters with prepaid fare, and they'll behave in a much more routine basis or ongoing basis. And so when we looked at those two stations, we saw between 18 and 22%. And so you have to, it becomes like an advanced math problem, but when you take that and then you extrapolate that against your, the 40% of your, your TVM activities for specific fare media, it gets closer to the range of what the sheriff's report. I mean, there's definitely an impact in terms of revenue increases, but we didn't look at – this doesn't really tell you fare evasion as much as it – because, again, you have to look at boardings versus TVM revenue. Yeah. And so when you start breaking it down and
I got it. But nonetheless, we do see a 68% rise in revenue.
No. It's a rise in cash.
In cash.
Majority of the fares are prepaid.
I see. Okay.
Right.
And if we – so we see some increase in revenue, not – as significant as I guess we would see with that 60% number. But I've been told that, you know, issues of how much it will cost to put up gates, other issues that we're still not going down that path, that we would prefer to keep things as they are. Is that accurate?
No, only maybe a comment. One concern we've had is Metrolink, because the bulk of their folks transfer right here at Union Station. If we they're not tap compatible. And that's another long side story on this issue.
But in those places where we can.
Well, bear with me just for a moment. If their fare revenues drop, we subsidize them, so then our cash payments to them drop, so we're caught in a bind. I spoke to my counterpart at Metrolink a couple months ago and communicated that the board was becoming impatient on this issue, to say the least. And that they either need to make their system tap compatible or confront the fact that we may lock the gates anyway and require their folks to buy tickets. Some weeks ago, three or four weeks ago, the CEO told me that he believes they'll be able to be tap compatible in some fashion or another in the March-June time frame. This was discussed at a previous committee today.
our goal would be to come back soon and talk about locking the gates June, maybe, or maybe May, something like that. And then we can take this out of the realm of speculation and opinion as to how much, what the real impact is of revenues. And we'll field test it, and we'll see what it costs. And
there are other issues, safety, right? And criminals don't want to pay fare, and they would rather go in and, I mean, they're there to commit crime, not to pay their fare and commit crime. That's what the sheriffs have told us. And secondly, if they are, if the office sheriffs are not patrolling those areas, they could get relieved from those duties and go off and do other things rather than stick around the unlocked gates, the locked gates. So there are other factors we should consider as well. I just think this needs a little bit more looking into, and it's one of the issues when I first became a board director I found quite interesting. I just don't fully understand all the dynamics involved, and it seems counterintuitive to what we should be doing, but it sounds like there's some good explanations. I just don't see them yet, but it deserves additional look. I just don't know what that is or what forum do we hear this again.
Thank you. I have a speaker, Worth Baker.
Hi, Worth Baker. I was wondering, as far as the MetroLink problem, I was just made aware this week that they could ride for weather passes on the MetroRail. Wouldn't it be possible for them to, like, when they buy the MetroRail pass, to get, like, a receipt with a code, they could go online and type it in, assuming they already had a tap pass, and that would give them that 30 days, whatever, that way they could use the tap pass and but you get credit for having the MetroLink pass. My other question is, when the gates are locked for a test period right now, when someone buys a paper ticket, how do they get through? They just walk through the wheelchair lane, or how do they get through right now with a paper ticket?
The gates are free spinning right now.
Okay, but if they were locked at Normandy, how would they get through? There has been practice or no?
The ticket would be converted to staff.
Okay. Because, I mean, it seems like the taps sell for $2. It seems like it just make it required that everyone use a tap. It's not that big of a deal to buy a $2 tap, even if you only use it once in your life. It's not the end of the world.
Thank you.
Is this going to executive committee, or already has gone there?
This is also on.
Yeah, it was discussed this morning. The same, very much the same conversations we've had here.
Yeah.
Okay. If there's no objection and no further questions, we'll receive this report. Item 50.
A couple quick items. As you may know, we were included in the federal New Starts report, which is a good thing for the connector and the subway. In addition, the President's budget includes money for both projects. That's a big milestone to pass. Those projects are still going to take a lot of work and a lot of years, but we've started them. The expo opening, I hope that we'll have a date in the next week or so. As of last Monday, we had about 17 showstoppers. That is technical, mechanical issues on the line which need to be addressed before we can begin full revenue, pre-rev, and begin talking about an opening. But we are making progress, I'm pleased to say. In the coming weeks, I'm going to announce an executive assignment on, I think, an important area of potential crisis. I've been talking with you for the last year or longer on what I've called the next generation problem, which is we confront the baby boomers' generational transition in the next several years, in which baby boomers retire or drop dead or whatever. And in that
mix, looking for guidance on which one?
Well, we all have our preferences, you know. Sometimes add to that the potential for a state action that would affect public employee retirements. The fact that we have more than 1,000 employees who are retirement eligible, we could confront a crisis in the fourth quarter of the current year, depending upon what may emerge from that. Add to that that we face the challenge of increasing complexity, especially in the operations area of buses and rail cars, which are very, very technically advanced. We have radio systems and fare systems, apropos of the previous item, issues which require a high level of technical knowledge. Finding people with those skill sets is going to be a challenge. Add to that the fact that the military is downsizing and redeploying as a consequence of the ends of the actions in Iraq
Afghanistan. And what I want to do was designate an executive to do outreach, to work on this next generation issue, to do outreach to the military, and to try to do a recruitment program to bring returning veterans to work here at the MTA. Clearly, people who've done that have a work ethic. They understand big organizations, and many of them have excellent skill sets where they have worked on radios and equipment and helicopters and the like. So I will keep you posted on this as this develops. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one more item, item 53.
I'll second it.
The motion was made by Director Huizar.
I will move it.
In advance, an attempt to find replacement for the Travelers Aid Society services that were previously offered. And if there's no objection, such a motion is approved.
Thank you.
Public comment. Worth Baker.
Worth Baker. And normally when there's a general board meeting, there's many more speakers than just me. And it seems there's a lot of time spent people queuing or not queuing up. And when we announce who's speaking next. I'm a computer programmer. It looks like the system you currently have is probably like 10 to 15 years old. And would you guys consider having it reprogrammed where you could actually on the one side have it listed who's speaking next, like the next three people, so there's less time between speakers? Like, it seems that there's often a massive delay at big board meetings. Thank you. I could probably do it myself if you guys wanted it done.
I think we prefer the oral method. We don't want our speakers' names up in lights. That would lead to all sorts of issues. Director Fasano.
Yes, just briefly, I've asked my deputy, Mary Lou Echternach, to look at a possible motion to indicate on our Metro website planned road closures for our highway system, predominantly the freeways. I know we have the occasional Armageddon, but on a daily basis, we have all sorts of planned road closures that are out there. I've seen the Caltrans information. I don't think it's really adequate or user-friendly. So I think for all the highway users that we have and maybe getting some additional attention to our website and what we do, having a good site that would include that information I think would be helpful. So if there's any ideas, if people want to work with Mary Lou on that, we'd like to bring something forward.
Yes, sir. Thank you. That concludes our business. Is there a motion? We're going to let you speak, Mr. Walsh.
Don't worry, you're going to like what I have to say.
Okay. John Walsh.
First of all, the comments you made about Mr. Najarian about not wanting Glendale to look like East LA was on site. It's terrible over there. The reason it's terrible over there is their politicians have sold out. Yes, it's scummy over there, and that is because their politicians sold out to developers. That's why, and it's true. Take a walk around Glendale and take a walk around East LA, and it's Gloria Molina's fault that it's like that. That's why it's like that. We will be asking formally that the mayor step down as chairman of the MTA. He's running the city. He's running the National Council of Mayors. Now he's running the Democratic National. He cannot do all these things. We're asking him to step down, and then Mr. Dubois becomes the chairman. That's the way it should be. We are asking for it. HollywoodHighlands.org. Thank you.
Thank you. And for the record, I have apologized to all the fine people of East Los Angeles for those insensitive remarks that I made. No slight was ever intended. Thank you. I apologize.
I apologize.